which means everybody has faith. It's either going to be in something or it's going to be in some things. But what's interesting is that in every day, in countless ways, we put our trust in things that we know very little about. For example, without giving it any thought, every one of you sat down in that chair trusting and believing it would hold you up. Some of you might have even inspected the chair and checked it out first, right, to see. But all of you trusted in the strength of the chair to hold you up, right? And you didn't even think about it. You just sat in it. We do this all the time in countless ways, don't we? We trust in things without even asking why. I mean, take, for example, going to the grocery store. There's an exercise in faith, right? Every time you go to the grocery store, you're trusting in the products that are there. I mean, do you know where the meat came from? Do you know how old the meat is? Do you know how it was processed? But still you buy it. What about produce, right? You don't know if the farmers use harmful chemicals on the produce, but you buy it. You trust it, right? Without even thinking about it. See, what's my point? Everybody has faith. And we trust in things all the time without really knowing a lot about it. So if it's easy for us to trust in things that we know very little about, then why is it so hard for us to trust in God? I mean, we don't question what the food that we buy, we don't question what it may do to us, but we do question what God is doing in our lives, don't we? We don't question whether the meat in the store is good, but we do question whether God is good. None of you question whether the chair would hold you up, but we all doubt and we all question whether God's power is enough to hold us up when everything in our world comes crashing down. Why is it easy for us to trust in things that we do not know a lot about, but it is so hard to trust in God and His care for our lives? There are many answers, but I only want us to think about two. The first one, which is the most universal reason why it is hard to believe and trust in God, and that is this: because we can't see Him. It is hard to trust in the one whom we can't see. See, everybody, you can see the chair. And so because you can see the chair, it's easy to believe it's going to hold you up. But because you can't see God, it's harder to believe that He can hold you up. See, our circumstances, our experiences, our emotions, our perceptions are the things that impact and influence how we see the world. What we see, in other words, becomes more real to us than what God says. It's hard to trust in what you cannot see. And then the second reason why it's so hard to trust God is because we're not in control. Right? We're not in control. We may think we are. We may think we can control circumstances, situations, and other people, but we can't. Unexpected things happen in our lives. Things don't go our way the way that we planned them. And we can't control people or circumstances and situations. All right, parents, is it easy for you to trust God with your kids? Maybe when they're younger it is, but wait till they get older. And then kids, is it easy for you to trust God when your desires are different than your parents'? And then, holy cow, who here likes to be in the passenger seat with a teenage driver? I sure don't. Holy cow. In our text, Jesus is going to command us to do the hardest thing for us to do. And that is to keep on believing in Him when things are out of our control. And when we don't understand what He's doing in our lives. And why not? I'll have you stand. We're going to read Mark chapter 5, verses 21 through 43. So don't lock your knees. because it is longer. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, and well, I'll give you the context later. I preached on both of those texts, so I'll bring it up later. I don't have to do that now. So when they crossed to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. And a great crowd followed them and thronged about him. Literally, they're pressing in. They're bumping into him, okay? And there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had, and she was no better, but rather she grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus, came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, "If I touch even his garment, I will be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "Are you crazy? You see the crowds pressing in around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. And the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any longer?" But overhearing what they had said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. And they came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion. People were weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But he put them all outside, and he took the child's father and mother and those who were with him, and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, rise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this, and he told them to give her something to eat. This is the word of the Lord. All right, I prayed, so we're going to jump in. All right, now, yeah, you got to remember where we are. All right, Jesus had just led his disciples through a terrorizing storm in the middle of a lake while they're on their way to the Eastern Gentile irreligious side, right? And then when they actually make it through the storm and then get to the shore on the other side, right? This howling man who is possessed by a legion of demons is coming after them, frightening them, right? So Jesus is the only one who gets out of the boat. He goes and confronts the man and the demons, casts them out, and they go into about 2,000 pigs who then run down the hill into the sea, and they all drown. And all the townspeople are so upset at losing their profit from the pigs that they told Jesus and sent him away to get out. And he does. So now they're on their way back to the western side. And did you notice how uneventful the boat ride was this time? There was no sharkia. There was no howling great wind coming after them. And then in verses 21 through 24, upon arriving, there's a great crowd that gathers around him. And Mark singles out one man who fought his way through the crowd and then falls at Jesus' feet, begging and pleading for him to heal his 12-year-old daughter. And this is a monumental occasion in Mark's gospel, okay? Because this is the first time that a religious leader gets Jesus. So far, only the demons are the ones who understand and get who Jesus is. This is the first time that a religious leader does. So this is a significant point. Why? Because the religious leaders are the ones who oppose Jesus. They're the ones who keep their distance from Jesus. So what makes Jairus different here? Why is he seeking out Jesus? And why is he imploring and begging Jesus to help him? Well, this is not the main point of the story, but it is a significant point that I want to draw your attention to, okay? Because Jairus is the first religious person who gets Jesus, he, in a sense, is the model of how religious people can get and understand Jesus. You see, so far in Mark's gospel, right, it's the religious people, they're suspicious of Jesus. They keep their distance from Jesus. They don't like what he's doing, and so they're out to get him. And now one of them humbly falls at Jesus' feet and implores Jesus for help. And the question is, why? Answer, because Jairus is desperate. Jairus is in great need. Jairus is experiencing emotional pain. The little girl that he loves deeply is about to die, and he's helpless to do anything to help her. You see, religious people get Jesus when they realize how needy and desperate they really are for Jesus. When I did campus ministry at Baylor, there was a church in Waco that was famous for being on fire for Jesus, okay? Their college ministry, every year for spring break, they would take over 800 kids to Juarez, Mexico, okay? That's a lot of students to take on a spring break trip that isn't to a beach destination, right? Almost every student at Baylor knew of somebody who went to this church. And many of our students in RUF felt like they were somehow subpar Christians because they weren't healing people like these other students were. They weren't speaking in tongues like these other students were. They weren't always sharing their faith with other people like these students were. So I would say to our students who knew students who went to this church, I would say, make sure you're there for them when they have a bad day. Because inevitably, the day will come when they actually sin and fail and fall short of Jesus. And they're going to be so ashamed that they're going to need somebody there to tell them that Jesus is a God of grace, that Jesus can forgive, that Jesus is merciful. So be there for them when they have a bad day. Religious people have a hard time getting Jesus and his grace because they're disconnected from their desperation and need of him. Sure, they may do a lot of spiritual things for Jesus, but they keep their distance from Jesus and they live as if they don't really need him and his grace. But see, it's those who are desperate. It's those who know that they need him. Those are the ones who run to him, fall at his feet and say, Jesus, will you please help me? I can't do it. And there are some of you who haven't reached the point of desperation yet. You are disconnected from your need of Jesus. Now, you would consider yourself a good person because you associate with Jesus. And because you haven't done really bad things like other people that you know, but how close to him are you really? In your easy, comfortable life, how much do you really feel your need of him? And have you ever fallen at his feet? Have you ever begged and cried out, Jesus, help me. I can't do it. I need you. If this is you, here's what I want you to know. When you have a bad day, when you fail and fall, this church is here for you. We want to be here for you. We want you to be a part of this church body because we want you to see how much you really need Jesus and how his grace is always greater than your sin. always. And then there are some of you here who you know you're desperate. I mean, desperation has left its imprint on your heart, but you don't know what to do. Okay? Here's the new Christian slogan for Redeemer Presbyterian Church. Be like Jairus. Okay? Be like Jairus and go to Jesus in your desperation. Implore him to help you. Acknowledge your need. Acknowledge your weakness. Acknowledge your brokenness. And take it to him. You see, because he's not just able to heal you. He's willing to heal you. Look at verses 22 through 24. Jairus, he's a ruler of the synagogue. He's a man devoted to God. He's a man of authority and status who is highly respected in his community. And yet this man falls at the feet of a Galilean carpenter, begging him for help. And can you feel his desperation? I mean, this is a helpless father who loves his daughter. And in verse 23, he literally says, death is knocking at my little girl's door. I beg of you, come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live. See, Jairus is desperate and the need is urgent here. But in verse 24, everything changes because Jesus goes with him. When Jesus goes with him, it changes everything. You see, Jesus is entering Jairus' desperation by going with him. By going with him, Jairus' desperation is turning into hope, right? Hope that the daughter that he deeply loves now has a chance. Jesus can heal her. Help is on the way. My daughter's going to be okay. And while everybody's speed walking to Jairus' house, we have this intrusion. We have this interruption. We have this detour. We have this divine delay. Because in verse 25, we're introduced to somebody else who is desperate and in great need, a bleeding woman. In verses 25 through 34, Mark is doing something what scholars call the sandwich principle. He's interrupting one story with another story, which means the story that's being sandwiched into another story fills in and interprets both stories. So the sandwich story, in other words, is the main point of both stories, okay? And I want you to notice the similarities and the differences between these stories. Both the woman and Jairus are desperate. But we know Jairus' name. We don't know her name, okay? Jairus is a respected religious leader in the community, and what is his identity? He's a ruler of the synagogue. This woman, she's unclean. She's outcasted. And what's her identity? Bleeding. According to Old Testament law, a woman was unclean for 7 days after her monthly period. Anyone who came into contact with her would be banished until purification rites were performed. So 2 weeks of every month, a woman was unclean and not allowed to enter the temple. This woman's been unclean for 12 years. She hasn't been to the temple in 12 years. And how old is Jairus' daughter? 12 years old. This woman's been bleeding for 12 years. So while Jairus' little girl has been healthy, growing, and energetic, this woman has been drained and her health's deteriorating. Now, the obvious question to ask at this point is, which case is more urgent? I mean, you have a chronic problem of bleeding that is not life-threatening, and a little girl who is standing at death's door. Any physician in our country would be sued of malpractice if they went to the woman before going to the little girl, right? And yet Jesus stops the speeding caravan. And he says, who touched my garments? And I love the disciples' response because it's literally, are you kidding me? What do you mean, who touched you? There are hundreds of people touching you. How in the world do you know which one did, and why are you asking? And verse 32, it's interesting because it's in the present tense. So Jesus is persistently scouring the crowds looking for who touched him. In other words, he would not stop until he found out who touched me. Now, can you imagine what the disciples and Jairus are thinking at this point? Holy cow. Jesus, come on, let's go! What in the world are you doing? Do you not realize the gravity of the situation and how grave this person's little daughter is? Hurry up, we gotta go! But Jesus is not going to be hurried. And maybe the reason why sheds light on the main point of this story. See, to capture how bad this woman's condition really is, in verse 29 and verse 34, Mark uses a word that sounds as bad as it means. Okay? Our translations say disease. But it's the Greek word mastix. She has a mastique. She's suffering from a mastique. She's healed of her mastique. And this is a fascinating word that has a double meaning because it literally means whip, lash, scourge, torment, curse. It means physical and emotional suffering and shame. So this woman is experiencing a physical hemorrhaging and a heart hemorrhaging at the same time. You see, she's not only suffering physically, she is suffering, period. She not only is experiencing shame, she is shame. Her identity is her mastiques. And look at how bad it is in verses 25 through 26. She's had this discharge of blood for 12 years. She's also suffered much under many physicians, not just a couple, many. She has spent all of her money on a cure, and her problem has only grown worse. So this woman has run out of money, and she's run out of options. Her situation is hopeless, and her condition is just getting worse and worse and worse. Now look at verses 27 through 29. But she heard reports about Jesus. She came up behind him in the crowd. She touched his garment, saying, "If I just touch his garment, I will be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her mastiques. Desperate people are not just driven to Jesus. They're attracted to Jesus. This woman, she's not a believer. She's superstitious at best here, okay? And do you realize that what she's doing by what she did? By joining the crowd, she just made the whole crowd ceremonially unclean. And then by touching Jesus, she makes Jesus ceremonially unclean. But she doesn't care because she's so attracted to the one that can heal her that she goes to him. And then when Jesus knows something happened to him, that somebody touched him, and then he wants to know who it is, she's scared to death. So Jesus has to search diligently for whoever did it. And then when she discovers, she goes to him in trembling and fear, falls down before him. And what is interesting, she tells him, we're told, the whole truth, which means she's telling Jesus her whole life story. See, this is how we know about verses 25 and 26, about her condition, because she told Jesus her whole life story. And you got to ask, how long did that take? You see, Jesus stops the caravan to Jairus' house because he wants to do more than heal this woman. He wants to know this woman. And he wants this woman to know and to trust him. So he takes the time for that to happen. See, how long did it take to hear her whole life story? And then can you imagine what Jairus and the disciples are thinking about this woman? and about Jesus' delay here? I mean, the longer Jesus takes talking to this woman, the less chance his daughter has to live. Jairus' hope, in other words, it begins to diminish with each passing moment. And then the dreaded report comes in verse 35, your daughter is dead. Why bother troubling the teacher anymore? Can you feel the despair of what Jairus is feeling at this moment? I mean, if you were Jairus and your little girl has died because Jesus delays, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't be calm. I'd be filled with rage. I'd be mad at the woman. I'd be mad at Jesus. I'd be mad at the world and everything in it. And right now, this is how some of you feel. You're mad at God. You don't understand what He's doing in your life. And in your desperation, you may get a little hope that, okay, Jesus enters my desperation with me. Okay, that helps. But then He delays. And He disappoints you. His timetable, it's not your timetable. His ways, they're not your ways. And now you're angry. You're filled with bitterness. You're filled with disappointment because you don't think God knows what He's doing. What are you doing? Why would you allow this? Why this detour? Why this delay? Trust you? I don't want anything to do with you if this is how you care and treat people. And then to make things worse, look at verse 36, because our translations say, but overhearing what they said. No, it means Jesus ignored what they said. Jesus paid no attention to what they said. Jesus refused to listen to what they said. Jesus discounted what they said. And it is precisely at this moment that Jesus looks all of us in the eye. And He's asking us to do the hardest thing for us to do. Fear not. Keep on believing. But how in the world do we keep on believing when we doubt the goodness of the one who asks us to believe? How do we keep on believing when there are divine delays? How do we keep on believing when we're desperate because we're not in control and we don't understand what God is doing in our life? See, the answer is found in the sandwich story of the woman. She's a nobody. She's an outcast. Her identity is her mastiques, and she breaks every purification law to approach and touch Jesus. And then when she's found out, what does she do? She, in her fear and trembling, she falls at His feet. But notice, rather than condemning this woman and reproaching her for doing this, Jesus has tender compassion upon her. Verse 34, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your mastiques. Be freed from your suffering. You are no longer identified by your mastiques. You are now identified by being in a relationship with Me. I wanted to know you, and now you know Me. See, Jesus stops the caravan because the most important thing in the world is to be in a trusting, life-transforming relationship with Jesus. You see, Jesus is asking Jairus to trust Him the way this woman did. He's asking Jairus to trust Him when he can't see what Jesus is doing. He's asking him to trust Him when he doesn't understand what He's doing. He's asking Jairus to trust Him when Jesus delays. And to help us to keep on trusting Him, I want you to see how Jesus deals with death in verses 38 through 41. When they came to Jairus' house and Jesus saw all the commotion with people wailing and weeping loudly because, you know, they had paid mourners, right, whenever there was a death. Because in Jewish culture, mourning was very important. It was a way to deal honestly with the reality of death. Okay, they didn't flee from it. They didn't ignore it. They dealt honestly with it. So he sees all this wailing and weeping, and he's like, why all this noise? What is the commotion about? And here it is. She's not dead. She's only asleep. See, the first thing that Jesus wants us to see about himself to make it easier to keep on believing in him when he delays or when we might not know what he is doing is to see what? Death to Jesus is no more than sleep. Death is our greatest enemy, isn't it? Death is our greatest fear, isn't it? All of us fear death. But death, it's nothing more than falling asleep. You see, Jesus controls death. Jesus has power over death. Death is like the terrifying storm at the sea where Jesus says, be still. Death is like the terrifying legion of demons tormenting this man. And Jesus says, out. And all is calm. Jesus can calm the storm and he can still the soul. Why? Because he conquers death. See, death is like sleep to Jesus. And I want you to look at his care for Jairus' daughter in verse 41. He takes her by the hand. Once again, he's touching that which is unclean. And look at how effortlessly and tenderly he takes her by the hand and he says to her, Talitha kumi, which is an endearing term. Little girl. It's the same word he says to the woman. See, when Jesus has us by the hand, death is nothing but sleep. See, Jesus can just as easily raise a girl from the dead as he can heal a woman of her mastique. But it's in what happens to Jesus when he touches the woman, when the woman touches him, which shows us why we can keep on believing in his care when we don't understand and when his timetable is different than ours. When the woman was healed, look at verse 30, what happened to Jesus? And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him. The word for power here is where we get the English word dynamite. Power went out from him, which means Jesus lost power. So this woman could be healed. Jesus lost strength so that this woman could gain strength. Jesus was weakened so this woman could be made whole. Jesus was diminished so that this woman could be saved. How do we know that Jesus is trustworthy? Because on the cross, Jesus was diminished and drained, not of some of his power, but of all of it. His life was extinguished and completely snuffed out. Jesus experienced his Father's terror on the cross so that we could experience his peace. See, on the cross, Jesus takes all of our mastiques, all that makes us unclean, and then gives to us all that is pure about himself so that we could be healed. So, yes, his delays cause us to question his care. They do. And yes, his timing may not be our timing. But to help us to trust him and his care, does the fact that Jesus lost his Father's hand so that we could always have it? Does that not help? Does that not help us to trust in His goodness when we question His goodness? Even when we don't understand what He's doing. And yes, He may delay, but ultimately He will come. And when He comes, He will take us by the hand and He will say, "Rise in My resurrection power. Rise and know You are Mine. Rise, because no one can snatch you out of My hand." Amen.